This is Romany Arrowsmith from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Glamour Magazine and Rookie Magazine. Our theme today is introversion, and this first article is called Class Act, and it's from Rookie Magazine. During my final 2 years of high school, I fell into a friend group that revolved around a guy I'll call Chris. Tall, lanky, and always full of energy, Chris was a personality type all of his own. Unlike me, he was a classic extrovert, someone who managed to bring himself into every conversation he encountered in a way that was mostly humorous, even if he was the one laughing the hardest. He was an accomplished performer who had directed a student-run show in his junior year and applied to top-tier colleges, eventually being accepted to one through early decision. Although Chris and I were in theater together and took a lot of the same classes, I rarely interacted with him directly. He had an up-close and personal relationship with my friends, but he never really acted the same way with me. Sensing that I wasn't very important to Chris, and given his importance to my friends and the general social atmosphere, I adopted a wallflower-type role whenever he was around. He was the sun, and I was a satellite. One day, nearing our midterm exam week, Chris did something not out of the ordinary for him. He made a Quizlet entirely about himself titled, "Are You a Friend?" and sent it to everyone he knew, insisting, "Everyone better get at least 75%. It contained questions like, "What type of noodle am I?" and "Is it okay to apply deodorant during Spanish class?" Abstract questions that were certainly open to personal interpretation. After seeing the decidedly dismal grades that followed, he sent out another email. "Okay, so it's come to my attention that results aren't too great. I will be holding a test correction session after school today. This is real. This is serious." That afternoon, he and around 8 other people, including me trailing along, hijacked the school's choir room for 2 hours after school and went over the answers for his quiz. Without anyone explicitly saying so, this test correction session became a complete improv act. Standing at the front of the room, Chris grabbed the teacher's microphone that connected through the classroom speaker system and plugged his computer into the projector for everyone to see. For the next 2 hours, Chris talked about himself and his life as though he was a professor, telling joke after joke tinged with his signature blunt sarcasm. The degree to which everyone played along was unreal. My best friend sitting next to me took out her notebook and started diligently taking notes, even using a highlighter. Two other friends argued about the make-believe class's extra credit assignment options. It was hilarious, even though everyone else took it so seriously that I was the one who most often broke character by bursting into laughter. But when Chris explained his eye-rolling tactic, if he and his friends decided they didn't like what someone was saying, he would point directly at his eyes, roll them, and walk away, I couldn't help but dart my eyes around the room, looking for anyone else who felt as weirded out as I did. Finally, Chris broke it off, remarking, "You guys, you realize this is probably the most narcissistic thing I've ever done." By this point, he had created a syllabus and a class rank roster, and we left that afternoon with a midterm video project assignment and a formal name for the class, AP Chris. Following that afternoon, I began to notice how Chris's influence affected different parts of my life. He had always been the center of attention no matter where he was, but now some of our mutual friends began to adopt his mannerisms. They would gossip about people, roll their eyes at those they didn't like, and tunnel their attention toward the select few they wanted to listen to. I wanted to purely hate Chris. He was pompous. He made me uncomfortable. When he was around, my self-confidence plummeted, and he appeared to be turning my friends into monsters. Somehow, though, I just couldn't bring myself to. Sure, I wasn't crazy about him, but everyone else was. They were all pretty serious about his class. I didn't know what to think. The AP Chris bit went on for a little while, but lost its humor to me after the first meeting or two. From my perspective, it turned from a group of stressed-out students poking fun at the system of AP courses, public school education, and college admissions, into one kid talking about himself in front of a bunch of girls. Most of the class roster was female. I jokingly remarked to my best friend that it had turned into the Chris fan club, which she and a few others who overheard agreed with. I stopped going to class meetings, but I still wondered who's there on Monday afternoons, watching his prezzies about his favorite kicks, or taking notes on his favorite rappers. AP Chris was, at its core, an unapologetic display of self-confidence. Only someone as bold as Chris could make and execute an entire fake AP course curriculum about himself and expect others to laugh along with him and then voluntarily memorize his favorite albums. I admire that kind of confidence. I recognize that Chris's unique power of holding people's attention is not an ability I have, and I won't deny that I was a little jealous. Maybe that was part of the reason that I was so turned off by Chris's in-your-face personality. Although, at other times, I thought of his antics as an amusing spectacle that was, if nothing else, fun to watch. Still, I wonder if there's a point where admirable self-confidence turns to grating self-absorption? I suppose the answer depends on whom you ask. As we got closer to high school graduation, it became easier for me to put things in perspective and care less about making Chris like me. Instead of trying to fit in, I put more of my energy into my own passions and met new people through that. As I began to let go of my preoccupation with Chris and to work on being friends with myself, our mutual friends also began to notice his not-so-great tendencies. By graduation, most people had drifted away from his universe. Everyone was calmer. I had my own identity now that I had escaped his shadow, an identity I was proud to graduate with and can't wait to take into the world. I have no doubt that Chris is ultimately destined for great things. He's a born performer and is absolutely unafraid to showcase his talents. While our personalities often didn't mesh, being around him taught me one thing. The world's a stage, but sometimes it's okay to sit back and watch the players play. Okay, this next article is also from Rookie Magazine, and it is by Misha Fraser Carroll. Its title is An Anxious Person's Guide to Public Speaking. Let's say you've written a script or outline, memorized it, practiced it a bunch, and you still feel like you're talking more like a robot than a human being. Simply telling yourself, be less nervous or relax already, might not help your anxiety, but having a task will. Here are specific actions you can actually do during your talk, not just ways of being the you you're supposed to suddenly inhabit. 1. Take a moment before you begin. As with memorizing the first few lines of your presentation, your first moments on stage are an opportunity to get comfortable. Walk slowly on stage or to the front of the room or wherever, with your head up and your shoulders back. Take a few seconds of silence and make eye contact with your audience to hook them before speaking. 2. Go slow. When you're nervous, every second can feel like an eternity. We tend to speed up to compensate for what we perceive as awkwardness and to get the presentation over with. So if you're having a hard time gauging your own speed, you can safely assume you're going a little too fast. Shoot for slightly slower than what normally feels comfortable. 3. Don't be afraid to pause. Know that you can always reset. Not just for yourself, but for the audience. Use pauses to your advantage, whether that's to let people ponder a question, to grab their attention, to remember your next point if you've forgotten it, or just to take a breath. As with pacing, a pause will feel longer and slower to you than it is to the audience. 4, intonation. Changes in pitch can also catch the listener's attention and help to stress your key points. Good news. This will come naturally as long as you're thinking about the words you're saying as you're saying them, and not thinking, I need to make sure I punch up this syllable. 5. Look at your audience. Don't worry, you don't actually have to make eye contact with anyone. Divide the crowd into 3 or 4 sections and distribute your attention among each one in no particular order. You can look at the tops of people's heads rather than directly meeting their gaze. 6. Use the space. If you're physically tense, you might stay glued to one spot, but it will feel and look more natural if you move around a bit. If you have space around you, use it. You'll be less conscious of every little movement your face makes and every syllable leaving your lips if you got some of the energy out through natural pacing. Nothing too drastic. Think a bit of two-stepping. Then, standing still can be a way to recenter yourself and check in with your audience. Striking the balance here can be hard, so it's a good one to practice in the mirror. Number 7. Use your hands. Another way of using your space. Illustrating your points with gestures will give people a visual, make you look and feel less stiff, and eradicate the, oh God, what do I do with my arms question. Number 8. Get the audience involved. This depends on the format of your speech, but for anxious public speakers, audience participation can be a godsend. If possible, consider having a few questions for the audience, e.g., raise your hand if, or can anyone give me an example of type questions? This gives you a chance to breathe, and it also keeps the dialogue between you and the audience open. Don't be afraid to be vulnerable. Sometimes public speaking can feel like starring in a one-person show. Depending on the formality of the context, a touch of vulnerability can make your audience feel let in and can ease your own stress. You can acknowledge that public speaking is scary, that you've forgotten a part of your speech and have to consult your notes, or that something hasn't gone as planned. When done well, this helps everyone in the room to relax. Whew, I know that's a lot to remember, so when you feel overwhelmed, focus on the core aim of the task at hand. You need to communicate a piece of information to other people. What's the best way to tell them? Making it about that and not what you look or sound or smell like will have the wonderful effect of making you look and sound and smell more relaxed. Besides, the person scrutinizing you the most is you. No one is policing your every word or blunder. So be free to have fun and bring all the energy you've got, including the anxious kind. You don't have to be a different, less anxious type of person at all. Just prepared, breathing, and trying to communicate. This next article is from Glamour magazine, and it is called Why Being Called Quiet is Your Secret Superpower. Hate leaving voicemails, making small talk at the hairdressers, or speaking up during meetings? This one's for you, by Gemma Ashkam. Why are you so quiet? Whether you've grown up asking it or ever been told to speak up, the message has always been the same. Quiet is bad. To the socially confident, quietness was something unnerving, boring, lacking personality. To the socially floundering, quietness was the birthmark you wished you could erase. Well, it was. Call it the 11 effect, the name of the often silent character in Stranger Things whose solitary disposition we collectively embraced, but quiet is officially in. Proof? The 11th most watched TED Talk of all time is called The Power of Introverts. Googling, why am I so awkward, a search term that spiked in 2011 and has not dipped since, has allowed the internet to bring like-volumed people together. Take Twitter's funny hashtag introvert problems or Gemma Carell's witty cartoons on social anxiety, Hell is Other People Before Coffee, which have earned her 420,000 Instagram followers. Even science has the quiet person's back. Introverts, who prefer their own company and call an Uber the second someone shouts group karaoke, were once criticized for making less effort than extroverts who socialize big and enjoy those ear-pounding exercise classes with lasers and garage music. Now we know it's actually down to our nervous systems. Introverts' systems are more sensitive to surroundings, so they crave quiet. Extroverts' systems react less, so they crave stimulation. Psychologist Hans Eysenck found that if you place lemon juice on your tongue, highly reactive introverts will actually produce more saliva, which suddenly makes being quieter seem less like a defect and more like a superpower. With even the chattiest among us being drowned out by fake news and social media spam bots, nothing says genuine friendships like gain likes underscore 137936699, socializing is moving from an extreme sport to a generation of happy part-time talkers, and even noise fans are catching on. You only have to listen to a politician's speech to know that what isn't said, think of Obama's silky pauses, can be more impressive than what is. There's so much noise in life that we may pay more attention when someone provides a better quality response, rather than blurting out the first thing that comes to mind, says Dr. Lori Helgo, a clinical psychologist and author of Introvert Power. We've had the buzz phrase, reach out, drummed into us, but Dr. Helgo believes there's also merit to holding back. A quieter person can be a refreshing alternative to quick-paced conversations that don't go anywhere. They listen. They respect privacy, so they're good secret keepers, They are also, as my extroverted sister tells me, great at coming up with the witty observation that no one else thought of because they let themselves sit back, take in all the information, and respond when they're ready. And the benefits of interacting quietly aren't just being trailblazed by the naturally quiet. Now the loud want in, too. People are claiming their quiet space. The trends for yoga and wearing noise-canceling headphones reflect this. Society has become so ambitious and on the go, asking members to be on all the time, that even extroverts feel it's too much, explains Susan Cain, the speaker behind the aforementioned 16 million viewed TED hit. Anyone who's ever longed to be louder likely knows her name. Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, her debut book, Normalizing the Less Chatty Among Us, has topped bestseller lists since its 2013 release. And its 2016 sequel, Quiet Power, is spreading the quiet is okay assurance to teenagers. A look in your local cafe shows many are already on board, though. People are drawn to the quiet coffee shop where you can be by yourself and not look weird, where you can enjoy being with people you don't have to talk to, adds Dr. Helgo. Like apart-together relationships, where couples deliberately spend weekdays apart or prefer living separately, we're now long-distance socializing, where we flit between verbal contact and friending over Wi-Fi. Sitting alone was once the pity seat. Now, it's a table for one. That's W-O-N. Table for one. Flexing your quiet muscle. While some of the world's biggest stars build their careers around verbally undersharing, Kate Moss, FKA Twigs, Victoria Beckham, even the Queen, quiet has traditionally been the wrong professional label. My most surprising criticism has been the reaction to my success, explains Samantha 26, a publicist. I moved out when I was 18, got a degree in political science, and then went to do my master's at New York University. But the common reaction was, wow, quiet Samantha? Really? To me, just because I was a bit reserved didn't mean I didn't have potential to do big things. It's this outdated charisma bias towards the loud. Research shows that charismatic CEOs are paid more but don't deliver better results, that led Cain to launch Quiet Revolution. It's an organization that teaches companies how to harness the best of the 30 to 50% of us who are quiet employees. Tech culture was one of the first forces to nudge us in this direction. Look at the great engines of technological development and you see quiet people. Microsoft's Bill Gates is the perfect example. He's a quiet figure and a powerful one, she says. Now, corporations are increasingly aware that they'll miss out if they only favor the loud. Some companies still don't get it, but many understand that to make the most of quiet employees' hearts and minds, they have to rethink. How do I design the office? How do I structure meetings? What space can I give them to put their heads down? All of this I see changing. In fact, some people are even carving careers out of their quietness. Fed up of feeling damaged for being quiet, Jen Granman, a former teacher, started blogging about her experiences. Growing up, classmates would say, "Why don't you talk more?" Teachers would tell my parents I needed to raise my hand more. When I joined the workforce, I felt like I was quietly slaving away, making valuable contributions, but the extroverts around me got more glory. So, instead, she quietly earned her glory. Her website, introvertdear.com, struck such a chord that she gets 600,000 page views a month and has a debut book, The Secret Lives of Introverts, coming out in August. Further evidence that you don't need to be loud to be heard. The low-volume future. In many ways, we've been lowering our offline volume for a while. For one, our crippling discomfort at leaving a voicemail. Second, even back in 2015, Bangor University found that 72% of 18 to 25-year-olds felt more comfortable expressing themselves using an emoji rather than words. Psychologist Tai Tashiro, author of new title Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome, believes we're a part of a new wave of the openly socially shy. I think that 20 and 30-somethings will be the fulcrum point for a cultural shift, he says. Young adults have grown up at the forefront of the social media age and a brazen reality television era, they've grown weary of so many people shouting for their attention and are looking for a more genuine experience with others. Whereas volume once attracted us, drawn to people's ability to take command of situations or social groups, Tashiro now believes fairness, kindness, and loyalty are weighted far more heavily. A quieter, less intense way of interacting is also transforming traditionally loud activities, restaurants that let you order via interfaces rather than face-to-face, hair salons with a quiet seat to skip the chatter, tech-free holiday retreats where you don't even have the noise of your phone's notifications. If you are dating and are bored of hearing the "What do you like on Netflix?" opener, London's Shh Dating organizes silent speed dating events where you play non-verbal games and gaze into each other's eyes. Their organizers believe that without words, without the hard sell, you can see who someone really is. The heart of the quiet movement is this acceptance that it's okay to step away from the saleswoman ideal, which we've long been told is the only way to be. In the 20th century, Western culture made a shift to accommodate the needs of businesses to sell products, and the needs of the entertainment industry to present larger-than-life figures. There was this imperative to go out, live among people you didn't know well, and sell yourself. We went through a shift from what cultural historians call the culture of character to a culture of personality, explains Kane. Today, it's beginning to change. And part of that change is giving ourselves space to think, to listen, to recharge. It's rediscovering that what makes us powerful isn't our volume. It's what's in our minds, even when the volume is on mute. So here are Susan Cain's tips on making people listen without being loud. 1. Speak early in meetings. The ideas submitted first are called anchoring ideas. Other people direct their attention towards you, and you psychologically feel part of things. Wait, and you slope to the margins. Try tactical silence. Making a complaint? Negotiating a bill? If you make your point and then deliberately stay quiet, most people will likely say anything, hopefully a helpful compromise, to fill the uncomfortable silence. Have a listening limit. Dinner for two turning into a monologue for one? A simple, "I've loved hearing about X. That reminds me, I must tell you about X." It shows interest, but also that you want to make them a part of your news too. Say it with a gesture. If someone butts in before you finish speaking, Kane says, using a hand motion, such as slightly raising your palm, to alert them that you're still going, is more effective than trying to out-volume an interrupter. Believe what you say. Someone who speaks less frequently, but with conviction, not just conviction about any old, ill-considered idea, but about something that makes sense, can end up having a lot of power in a discussion. All right, and this last piece is once again from Rookie Magazine by Rose Lichter-Mark. And it's a birthday tribute to the poet Emily Dickinson, a famous introvert. For decades, Emily Dickinson rarely left her room. She sat at a simple desk by her bedroom window on the top floor of her family's house at 280 Main Street in Amherst, Massachusetts, and wrote poems. Only about 10 of the almost 1,800 poems she wrote were published during her lifetime, and those were probably submitted to journals and publishers anonymously, without the poet's knowledge, by friends or relatives. When she passed away in 1886 at the age of 55, her family found a hidden treasure trove, massive bundles of papers and handmade chapbooks, filled with the many, many powerful poems that distinguish her as one of the greatest literary talents of the 19th century. Her compact, riddle-like verses about nature, mortality, and the soul will probably be dissected and discussed in schoolrooms and lecture halls for as long as English is spoken, and possibly longer than that. But although her art is held in the highest regard, her biography has been sentimentalized with romantic theories about why she lived her adult life the way she did, avoiding most human contact, rarely venturing past her house and its garden, and after her father died in 1874, dressing head to toe every day in white. She's often described as a fragile woman-child, a wraith-like spinster, a proto-goth weirdo. People speculate as to her mental, physical, and emotional health. There are volumes of scholarship devoted to hypotheses about what might account for her self-imposed isolation. Was she heartbroken? Agoraphobic? Epileptic? Blind? There had to be something wrong with her. Why else would a person want to spend so much time alone? I was recently in the car with my dad when the Beach Boys' "In My Room" came on the radio. "It's Rosie's song," he said, turning it up. "It's been more than a decade since I lived at home, but he's still right. As long as I can remember, I've longed to be by myself. Growing up, I was lucky enough to have my own bedroom, and I guarded my space like a dog with a bone. I wanted to shut my door to my raucous family, the pressures of friendships and social interactions, daily worries and long-term fears, the basic humiliations of being a human person in this world. This was hard for my family to understand. When I'd lock the door, they'd all want in. My brothers were convinced they were missing out on something truly thrilling, while my parents outlawed locked doors on safety grounds. I never really understood this. What did they think I was going to do? Rug burn myself to death? Get tangled in the curtains and suffocate? Bleed out from a horrific stepping on a Lego-induced wound? Okay, that last one at least seems possible. My only peace was late at night after everyone went to sleep. I'd read with my flashlight so that my dad wouldn't know I was awake. Staying up late, also taboo. At night, I could focus my thoughts and finally find the privacy I craved. I've never been a big reader of poetry. I tend to think in cascading sentences, and I find line breaks hard to follow, but I've always thought of Emily Dickinson, who was born 182 years ago today, as my own personal patron saint of creative solitude. And zines. She made zines that she called fascicles. Others may see Emily's reclusiveness as a symptom of a problem, but I always saw it as a solution to one. It was the 19th century, and Emily Dickinson, a woman, wanted to be a writer. So she retreated from the obligations that would have absorbed her time and energy. Marriage, motherhood, keeping up appearances, the social expectations that came with her family's privileged station. One afternoon, while her niece was visiting, Emily made as if to lock her bedroom door with an invisible key and said, "It's just a turn and freedom." For Emily, solitude meant not imprisonment, but the opposite, a release from expectation. Writing poetry made another kind of liberation possible. It gave her the opportunity to inhabit multiple shifting selves beyond the limited identity her class and culture offered her. Poetry allowed her to see beyond the confines of her room, and indeed herself. "The brain has corridors surpassing material place," she wrote in one poem. Like most of her poetry, it has no title. Emily didn't write for fame or fortune. She wrote for herself, because it was the only way she saw to leave the narrowness of human experience, the walls of so many rooms behind. Folks don't like it when you tell them you need to be alone. The very notion is confusing to many, maybe most people. Friends and family can feel hurt or even angry when you choose being with nobody over being with them. And maybe they're even scared for you. Spending too much time alone makes you vulnerable to loneliness, the gloomy sister of solitude. But Emily Dickinson didn't spend all that time in her room feeling sorry for herself. Her separation was a means to an end. There is a solitude of space, a solitude of sea, a solitude of death, but these society shall be compared with that profounder sight, that polar privacy, a soul admitted to itself, finite, infinity. Solitude can be a revolutionary act. The soul selects her own society, then shuts the door. Emily taught me that. All right, we've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Romani Arrowsmith, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.